Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Kountzer, and I'm joined today by an author, artist, and comics journalist whose work has appeared in The Village Voice, The New Yorker, The New York Times, and dozens of other publications. He's the creator of Stan Mack's Real Life Funnies, Stan Mack's Outtakes, and Stan Mack's Real Mad. And he's currently traveling from coast to coast collecting the stories of Americans for his new series, These Days. Stan Mack, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thanks for the invite. Happy to be here.
Well, you're a New Yorker. Lately, though, you found yourself in the Los Angeles area with your wife and for a somewhat longer stay than you expected. What's it been like to be on the West Coast? I know that while you've been out here, you've been reaching out to various organizations and individuals. You've been looking for stories about how people are living their lives in these uncertain times.
True. In fact, we started to move into an apartment. We sold our 30-year-old apartment in the West Village and looked for something smaller so we could have a footprint on the West Coast as well, because my wife's family is from here. But we only got halfway into the apartment when the lockdown hit. And so we came out here because we had no choice. And I've been hanging out here and looking for some way to feel normal, which is why I started this cartoon series. But actually, I'm not traveling for them. I'm locked down like everybody else. The idea was that I would talk to people, sort of like we're doing now, which was a very comfortable thing for me to do. I did it for years at doing Real Life Funnies. And see whether I could find out how the country was doing one person at a time through this COVID period and also Black Lives Matter, the protest period, all of that. But it's catching people in their own life as much as possible by phone. That's how we travel.
It's a big change from when you were on the streets. You were doing Stan Mack's Real Life Funnies, and it originally featured the tagline, "All dialogue guaranteed overheard."
There was a reason for that. In those days, which was long before a lot of the, certainly the current wave of very smart and talented graphic novelists, there was nothing like that around, especially nonfiction. So the editors said to me, "Who's going to believe this is real? I swear it's real." And they said, "Well, who's going to believe you? It looks like a comic strip. What can we do to make it real?" So they decided, not only are we going to call it Real Life, we're going to put a tagline underneath it, nailing this thing by you guaranteeing every word was verbatim, which is not entirely true. It was edited.
So that was an editor's idea.
Absolutely. I had no idea, really, at that point. I had walked into Milton Glaser and Clay Felker had bought The Voice. And Glaser was very busy redesigning it. And he had come up with this idea. It was a concept, an art director's concept of a page of urban comics. He didn't have the cartoonist. The only person at The Voice at that time was Jules Pfeiffer, who was his own domain. But the idea that this would be a collection of urban comics meant that Clay was and Milton were going to have to find people to fill the page. And coincidentally, I walked in at that point, mainly an illustrator and former art director at that point, and said, "You know, I have an idea. What about if I walked around the city?" I thought this would be a one-shot, basically. "What about if I walked around the city and listened to people and sketched them? I love to draw people on the wing. And we'll do something." And he said, "That's a great idea. But remember, if it's in a comic strip format, it has to be every time." Comic strips are circulation builders. People will read them before going on to the serious stuff. I said, "I have no idea. You know, maybe there's two or three. But let's do it." So that's how it all came about.
Well, comics journalists seem to be everywhere these days. We've had a number of them on the show: Joe Sacco, Ellery Harris, Josh Neufeld, Sarah Glidden. I guess you may not have invented the form, but you were certainly a pioneer. And this comics journalism of yours goes all the way back to the 1970s. And this started as an experiment, and it just became... It became a comic that went on for 20 years.
It caught a wave. Life was very different in those days from today. This was the middle 70s. People were just coming out of, still protesting, nuclear protests and Wall Street protests and so on. Not so much the war itself. But there was a lot of that. And there was a lot of shifting. It was the feminist revolution. It was all sides of sexual freedom. Drug culture was in place. There was a lot going on. And the economy was tanking in New York at that time. And there was no cell phones. So there was a lot of stuff around. And I stepped into it, not understanding, really, not smart enough to know the bigger picture. But it really caught people's attention. I started to do it without any sense. I thought I was cheating. I was going into places I didn't belong and scribbling on a little pad and jotting down what people looked like. But it was entirely illegal. I didn't belong in any of these places. And yet, word was filtering back. I remember one reporter saying, you know, you're really, people want to know on the Upper West Side who you are. What's this all about? So little stories like that began to enter my thinking. And I thought, let's ride with this, whatever it is. And that's really how it got going.
Well, looking back now, Real Life Funnies seems to be in some ways a chronicle of a late 20th century New York that was weirder and funkier than today's gentrified version.
Absolutely.
A place now where bodegas and squats and live music clubs are becoming endangered species.
Yeah. You mentioned squatting. I spent a lot of time over in the East Village around Tompkins Square Park with squatters and homeless during a time when the gentrifiers were lurking, but hadn't quite grabbed the neighborhood yet, or the NYU for that matter. And became fascinated with this whole concept of taking over abandoned buildings and setting them up for low-income housing. But yet, that wasn't what was happening. So it was a battleground at that time.
So I'll mention right now that we are not able to meet in a studio. Current circumstances are closing all the audio studios. So we are in our own homes, and we're conducting this interview over the internet.
Well, so you're on the wing. The internet today, in those days, back in the 70s and 80s when I was doing Real Life Funnies, there was none of that stuff. I had to trek across town or take a subway or a bus to meet the people. And when it was the squatters, that was a whole different world. There's one example of that I've always enjoyed telling of a crazy time as a reporter messing with squatters and revolutionaries over there. I was with a gang of anarchists who had taken over an empty abandoned building across the street from Tompkins Square Park as a sign of protest. And they hung flags out the windows. They were upstairs in this building to taunt the police, who were responding. And I went up with a friend of mine who was an activist in the East Village, in fact, was running a theater group called the Hobo Theater Company for and with the homeless. They were putting on a play called one of Gorky's plays that I think was called The Lower Depths, in which homeless people acting homeless people in the play. So his name was Bob. Bobby and I were with these revolutionaries, went into this building. The cops are coming in. Now, Bobby, a real character, had just had a baby. In fact, I had chronicled the baby's birth a few weeks earlier. So this newborn baby is wrapped on his chest. Her name was Chaya. You can figure out where that is derived from. And little Chaya is on his wrapped on his chest, and he and I are up with these anarchists. The police come pounding up the stairs, banging on the door. And first of all, I'm a reporter. I didn't need to go to jail at that time to do the story. And I probably would have missed my deadline. So he and I, with the baby on his chest, go out the back window, jump off a fire escape to the roof of a garage next to it. We could handle that. And then clambered off the roof and landed on the ground around the corner from the cops now breaking in to arrest these guys, which they did do. Bobby goes running off. I pull out my pad and look like I'm covering the story on the street. That's what I do. Later on, Bobby told me he went to the nearest phone booth, which they had in those days, and called up his wife to say, I would have gone. I would have been arrested. I was fine with that, but I just didn't have enough formula. Well, that was the last I saw of Chaya. And I've always wondered, what happened to Chaya? Where is she today? She's a grown woman today. I don't know if I'll ever find out, but that's something I'm fascinated by.
When you first struck out on your own as a comics artist, and this was, again, the mid-70s, you left a job as art director at the New York Times Magazine.
That's right.
Some people would consider that to be a pretty sweet gig and might be reluctant to give it up.
Yeah, I didn't see that way at all. But my then wife, who was a reporter herself, thought that would have been heaven to end up at the New York Times. And it was in a way, but I had come from the New York Herald Tribune. I'm talking about a world, a history probably going back further than a lot of your listeners. But the New York Herald Tribune set a graphic direction that the Times picked up on eventually. The graphic direction and the so-called new journalism embodied by Jimmy Breslin and Tom Wolfe and Gloria Steinem and Mailer, Pete Hamill, was an amazing time for journalists. So by the time I got to the Times, it was feeling a little bit repetitive for me. And I wanted to break out of the corporate world. So yes, you're right. And my folks never have recovered from me announcing I was leaving the Times, but that's what happened.
Well, the first comic of yours that I encountered was Mule's Diner, which ran in the National Lampoon's Funny Pages. It was generally a one-pager, often surreal, featuring tall tales in a modern environment, but with a moral fable or a mythological thread running through it.
Well, you mentioned mythological and surreal. I actually used as inspiration for those comics Native American folklore.
Oh.
And I would research through these collected works, and things would pop out, and I could see it becoming a story that I could put into this format. So I was doing this strange thing called Mule's Diner. And it was, as you suggest, surreal and bizarre. And a lot of people felt that I had to have been high the most time whenever I drew one of those things. But it was just, I don't know, something working inside my brain came out through that.
But you had this real slice of life kind of environment that everything was set in. You had, you know, the diner itself, although that was just a template, but
well, more than a template, it was a real diner in the Midwest. Mule's Diner was for real. And I had a gimmick, which was that you could tell any story under the sun that you could concoct, as long as in the pictures a guy walked into Mule and Mule had offered to give a free coffee to anybody whose story he enjoyed. So it gave me license to do anything I wanted, as long as it started in Mule's Diner.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And I'm talking today with author, artist, and comics journalist, Stan Mack. His latest project is These Days, Stan Mack's Mini Real Life Funnies. Back in the 90s, you took on this series of illustrated history books, and Stan Mack's Real Life American Revolution was the first one. And
that was the first one. That's right. I had done some kids' books, traditional kids' books, through the late 70s into the 80s. But I didn't feel I was a natural. I mean, I wasn't Maurice Sendak. I didn't. So the Real Life Funnies, the Real Life American Revolution was the first time I felt I could dig in on my own terms and come up with a book-length version of Real Life Funnies.
And then you followed that one up with The Story of the Jews, a 4,000-year adventure.
4,000-year adventure, yeah. And the same thing. Both of these things happened by purest chance. I didn't go looking for that. I did want to do books. I had no idea what books that would be. But I stepped backwards into both those assignments.
Janet Bodie, your partner for 18 years, she was your co-author on a number of young adult nonfiction books.
That's right. And we worked together. She used a variation on what I was doing, which was based on interviews. She's a terrific woman and magical with teenagers. And using techniques somewhat like what I had worked with as well, traveled around the country interviewing kids. And because of this incredible feel she had for teenagers, she would get them to open up to her in a way they would never do with any other adult. I watched it happen. It was magical. Anyway, we did these books together and traveled the world together. She got diagnosed with breast cancer in 94 and went through a year of treatment. And they said, okay, you know, you're free of it meant that it was in remission, really. But we were very happy about that. We bought a ticket, around the world ticket. And she said, Janet, it was a very funny woman, said, if we go fast enough and far enough, they'll never catch them. It'll never catch me. And that's background for some of this stuff. But it did come back. And by the late 90s, I was a full-time, I'd walked away from just about everything I had done, was doing, to become a full-time caregiver for this disease, this evil that had taken over her body. And that went on like that, getting worse and worse until the very end of 99. A few days before New Year's, I did a comic strip which ran in the suburban sections of the New York Times. I was doing an occasional weekly comic strip for the suburban section, which is kind of funny. How do you take real life funnies from downtown Manhattan and move it up to the suburbs and get something? So it was kind of a struggle, but it was also a lot of fun. But I did, in the last few days of her life, a comic strip about our life. And I look at it now and think, it was rough. Mm. But I didn't know at the time, because I was in bad shape and she was in bad shape. And we were looking for silver linings. We were looking for hope. At a time when the whole of the city was celebrating. It was between New Year's, Christmas and New Year's. And we weren't. But that was the underpinnings for the comic strip. And it ran. Why they ran it, I don't know. They just ran it. And it got back a flood of mail. Some of it beautiful, lovely, and some of it hateful. They could not stand. People were so offended that this comic strip, that they were opening up their Sunday papers at the table with their bagel and coffee in Connecticut, were horrified to read this raw, bold picture of two people struggling. It was really rough, but for the New York Times, they'd never gotten that kind of volume of mail in a suburban section before. So they ran a couple weeks of letters. They were not unhappy about the whole thing. And I wasn't either, because it's how I felt. It was real life funnies. And an editor, the editor of the Jewish History, saw it and said to herself, there may be a book in this. And she came to me and said, do you think we could do a book on your experiences as a caregiver? And I said, I'd love to try. It would be rough, but I'd love to try. Janet's sister said, are you crazy? Live that again? But I said, yes, it's actually going to help me. So from 2000 to about 2004, I worked on this book, which is Janet and Me. And it's a book that I hope will both introduce Janet, a real character, to readers, will offer some good parts to caregiving, warn them that the bad things are coming down the road when it comes to the medical profession, both advice and money and all the ways in which the medical profession, especially in those days, were not up to speed in the way they really are today, much more. So I don't know. That's Janet and Me, and I illustrated it. I didn't make a graphic novel out of it. It was still early. Graphic novels really hadn't hit that strongly in the early 2000s. And so I did a kind of a traditional narrative and inserted my drawings where they appropriately appeared throughout the entire book. So it's a book of art and drawings, just drawing, I don't even call them illustrations, my drawings, and a traditional narrative with a wide border on the side where I interviewed friends of Janet's. I traveled the country, really. She knew a lot of people around the country, and gave them their own voice on the sides of the book so that I didn't have to edit them into the running narrative. I thought that would be a truer picture of what they said. So it's a little bit different format.
Yes, the book's called Janet and Me, An Illustrated Story of Love and Loss.
Yes.
And well, it's true. You know, as you say, you don't know completely what you're going through until it's over.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what happened. I went through, luckily, she was a prolific writer and a prolific note taker and email saver. So I didn't have to make up anything. I just had to bring my own life experience together with her notes of what had happened and my memory and put it together that way. I don't know what I would have done without, I couldn't have done it without her note taking.
Well, the story resonates very deeply. Yeah, the parts where especially you're the main caregiver. And this is a story that repeats itself thousands of times in this country, where ordinary people find themselves mastering these skills to care for their loved ones. And our medical system still relies on amateurs, like life partners.
Yeah. Well, I think it's changed. I remember we were connected to Beth Israel for a while, which is now, I think, Mount Sinai. And I briefly was on the board. I was the, in a sense, patient advocate among a bunch of professionals on the board at that time. And I was seeing the conversations change as they began to realize that they needed special counselors, special services available for people at that stage of life. And they were creating departments to do it.
Well, let's talk about the work you're doing now, because not only are you on a whole different coast, a new chapter in your life, you're working with your current wife, Susan Champlin.
Right. We've done two graphic novels.
The Road to Revolution series, right?
And Fight for Freedom. Kind of realistic look. We were trying to weave a fictional story into good history. So they're pretty good books, both for fun and for their history. But anyway, those are two things we did. We're moving on in other ways now, not just together, but separately. She's a business writer as well. The thing I'm doing now, these days, the reason this series started was me trying to experiment with something real. So it's natural for me to think about whatever's happening in the news today, and that was people staying home, not being able to go to work, having to create a workstation in their living rooms, what's happening with the protest movement. And I would call people, because that's what I do naturally. Everybody knows somebody. If I haven't asked you already, I will, for names of people I could follow up with and talk to about their lives. And out of that has come this series.
Yeah, your new series is called These Days, Stan Mack's Mini Real Life Funnies. And they tend to be one panel, slices of life from all kinds of people across the U.S.
The country is filled with solid journalists, both online and on paper, covering the events. There's no way I can compete on that level. So my choice is to zero in on one person's situation and talk to them for an hour and distill down to four or five sentences tops, because you're not going to read that much more. It's just a single picture, a cartoon. And find that essence, that nugget, that expresses their life.
So in these days, these stories that you're collecting, they seem to have a wide range of sensibilities to them. I mean, some are dealing with all of the political upheaval, the societal upheaval that we're doing. Some of them are just slices of life, people carving out new avenues for themselves or musing on the projects that they've taken on for their life.
It's that simple. And I'm hoping that I can find that gem that it works. Sometimes soft. Last week it was butterflies in the canyons of New York, because a friend of mine put out a couple of shrubs that monarchs are attracted to. In the meantime, though, there's been a couple other types of butterflies have shown up. And so they've brightened his day, because he and his wife are not going anywhere. They've been inside for months. So there were butterflies. So that's, you know, on the other hand, I've talked to a paralegal yesterday, who's working with people down in Albuquerque who are poor people who are being evicted from low-income housing. That's a serious story about a topic that is very much in the headlines. What's going to happen with people being evicted who don't have any money? Where are they going? What about the landlords who are evicting them? That's a solid story. So I don't mean to sound like a reporter here, but there are little gems that I think will resonate with readers. In fact, if your readers are interested, I'm happy to field their calls too, whatever their topic.
Well, you'll have to let us know how to get in touch with you that way. I know that these days, the series is running on your Instagram feed, which is RealStanMac.
Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And now the Santa Barbara Independent has picked them up as well.
Are there any plans for a collection of These Days comics, or are you just working on it as a continuing series right now?
I'm doing it. It's fun to do. I'm working with color in a different way because it's in the iPad. And I'm not pitching anything. I am in touch with an agent who, what she is interested in is, there's a lot of nostalgia among, let's say, 19-year-olds for past eras of history, especially New York history. There's the 60s and 70s, of course, but there's also the 80s and 90s. And my comic strips, I did them for 20 years. Those real-life funnies are a picture, a bottom-up picture of New York, not just a collection of drawings or themes, but a picture of New York in the 70s and 80s that she thinks would be attractive. So that's another thought.
And not the big deal makers or celebrities. These are people who are, you know, working, sometimes putting on costumes for street performances, just people who are making a living working with their best talents.
That's right. And you mentioned street art. That was really the beginning of it that I'm aware of in the 70s. Suddenly, street performers were everywhere in New York. I don't know exactly what brought that on, but and all kinds of backgrounds. So there are a lot of them in real life funnies, but they somehow capture the essence of a city in transition.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today has been Stan Mack, author of numerous books and comic collections, and creator of These Days, Stan Mack's mini real-life funnies. Stan, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you today.
I loved it, Conser. Thank you.
Now, for our listeners who might be interested in your various projects, how can they find out more, and how can they get in touch with you?
Well, Facebook or Instagram.
And that's Mack, M-A-C-K.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks again. And thanks also to our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. And a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program.
For me, too.
You can find an archived version of the show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.